Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we cut through the noise, unearth the most important insights, and deliver them to you with just enough surprising facts to keep you hooked. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. It's always good to be here, especially when we're tackling a period this dense with policy shifts.
Today, we're embarking on a deep dive into the federal news update for Thursday, August 14th, 2025. Our mission, really, is to give you a truly comprehensive and granular report on every significant action and activity of the U.S. federal government that either took place or took effect from the beginning of August 13th through August 14th, 2025.
Right.
We'll not only chronicle these events, but also thoroughly discuss and debate their immediate impact and long-term implications.
And this particular 48-hour window was, frankly, it was a whirlwind of concentrated policy implementation. What truly stands out, I think, is how almost every significant move was driven by the executive branch. It offers a critical, almost X-ray-like snapshot into the administration's strategic thinking and how they're actively trying to reshape fundamental areas of American policy.
These 48 hours weren't just a random flurry of federal activity, were they? They seemed to represent a carefully orchestrated, multi-pronged effort. As you dug into the sources, what deeper threads started to emerge, connecting seemingly unrelated actions across different departments?
Yeah, that's the striking thing about this period. You see these distinct, powerful themes consistently appearing. First, we see targeted deregulation being wielded as a very deliberate form of industrial policy. It's far beyond just a simple hands-off approach. Second, there's an unmistakably assertive America-first posture dominating both economic and foreign affairs, often with a sort of unilateralist bent.
Okay.
Third, we observe a contentious, even aggressive campaign to fundamentally remake federal health and social policy. That's a big one. And finally, there's a persistent testing of the traditional boundaries of executive authority, pushing against established norms and legal limits in, well, surprising ways. These aren't isolated incidents. They're interconnected by these larger overarching strategies. It makes this period truly pivotal.
So we're looking at a deliberate, multi-pronged effort to transform policy across the White House, Departments of Justice, Health and Human Services, Treasury, and Defense. A lot going on.
A huge amount.
Our deep dive today is structured to first examine the administration's reframing of the American economy. Then we'll look at its assertive foreign and national security operations. After that, the profound and frankly controversial reshaping of the nation's health infrastructure. And finally, its approach to domestic governance and the scope of executive power. Our goal is that you'll come away from this feeling genuinely well-informed, with a deeper understanding of the strategic currents at play here. Okay, let's start with the economic actions, because they truly reveal a coherent and, well, assertive agenda. This isn't just about reducing regulations for the sake of it, right? It feels more like a strategic tool designed to promote and favor specific domestic industries, almost like the government is actively playing favorites.
Yeah, the core insight here, I think, is how this administration is subtly yet fundamentally reshaping our economic operating system. They're not just rolling back regulations. They're strategically weaponizing deregulation as a precision tool for industrial policy.
Weaponizing deregulation. That's a strong term.
It is. But I think it fits. Instead of the traditional antitrust focus on, policing market power and preventing monopolies, they're equating competition with the unfettered growth of nationally important industries. It's a deliberate pivot from market referee to active economic architect, explicitly choosing to foster certain sectors by dismantling traditional oversight.
And the centerpiece of this economic recalibration, as our sources show, was that formal reversal of the preceding administration's big competition policy. On August 13th, 2025, the president signed an executive order that, with just a single sentence, revoked Executive Order 14036, promoting competition in the American economy.
That's right.
So from your perspective, what exactly was that prior order trying to achieve? And why do you think this White House saw it as such a critical, almost symbolic first target for reversal?
Well, Executive Order 14036, issued back in July 2021 by the previous administration, established what they called a whole-of-government framework. Its primary purpose was to combat excessive concentration of industry, abuses of market power, and harmful effects of monopoly and monopsony.
Monopsony, right? Where a single buyer has too much power.
Exactly. Like in labor markets, for instance. It was quite sweeping, directing federal agencies to actively challenge anti-competitive practices across diverse sectors, agriculture, labor, healthcare, tech. It reflected a philosophy that viewed government as an active referee, stepping in to ensure fair play and prevent too much power from accumulating in too few hands.
Okay.
Its revocation signals a pretty profound ideological shift.
So a significant shift in philosophy. What was the administration's stated rationale for getting rid of such a comprehensive order?
Well, the Department of Justice's antitrust division was quick to support the move. They framed it as an opportunity to recalibrate and modernize the federal approach to competition policy. They talked about pursuing an America-first antitrust strategy focused on free markets and explicitly rejected the prior administration's approach as overly prescriptive and burdensome. And this aligns perfectly with an earlier executive order from April 2025, which aimed to eliminate regulations that predetermine economic winners and losers. Essentially, the argument is that the old approach stifled innovation and growth by intervening too much in the market.
But wouldn't critics argue that stifling monopolies is precisely what fosters true innovation in the long run, not just, you know, unfettered growth for a few?
Yeah.
Senator Amy Klobuchar, for instance, had some pretty strong words about this, didn't she?
She certainly did. Senator Klobuchar, who is a very prominent voice on antitrust, called it a step backward for consumers, entrepreneurs, workers, and family farmers. She predicted it would lead to higher prices, fewer choices, and less innovation. And she urged the DOJ and FTC to continue vigorously enforcing antitrust laws despite the executive order.
Right.
So it really highlights a deep ideological divide here. One side sees active government intervention as necessary for fair competition and consumer protection. The other views it as an impediment to market forces and overall economic expansion.
So this America First antitrust isn't a neutral economic stance. It sounds like a very targeted strategy. It seems to clear the path for promoting certain industries without them facing scrutiny for the very dominant positions that might arise from these supportive policies.
That's a good way to put it.
It's essentially picking winners and dismantling the traditional tools that could later regulate them.
Precisely. And in the broader context, the revocation of these broad oversight mechanisms in EO 12036 was, you could argue, a necessary prerequisite for this new industrial policy to function without internal contradiction. Think about it. A company that gains significant market dominance in, say, commercial space, an industry we'll discuss in a moment, due to this new deregulatory approach. Well, it might have been a prime target under the old EO.
Okay.
The revocation ensures that potential growth in favored sectors won't be stifled by traditional antitrust concerns. It's a fundamental shift from policing power to actively enabling it in specific areas.
And speaking of commercial space, that leads us right into the next major economic action on August 13th, the Enabling Competition in the Commercial Space Industry Executive Order. This sounds like a direct real-world application of that new philosophy.
Exactly. And what's particularly insightful here is how specific and targeted this executive order is. Its stated goal is to solidify U.S. leadership in space by removing regulatory impediments and fostering a more dynamic private sector. And the explicit policy is to enable a competitive launch marketplace and substantially increase commercial space launch cadence and novel space activities by 2030.
Okay, so not abstract goals.
No, this isn't abstract at all. It's a measurable, ambitious target, setting clear goals for what this deregulation should achieve.
To achieve that, the order lays out some pretty specific directives, right? What are the most impactful actions it mandates? What should you be looking out for?
Absolutely. The order pushes aggressively on several fronts. First, on regulatory streamlining, it directs the Secretary of Transportation to eliminate or expedite NEPA, that's the National Environmental Policy Act reviews for launch and reentry licenses.
Expedite environmental reviews.
Yes. And it also mandates a comprehensive reevaluation of FAA Part 450 regulations, which govern commercial space transportation licensing, to eliminate outdated, redundant, or overly restrictive rules. This directly addresses long-standing industry complaints about cumbersome licensing processes. You hear that a lot from them.
Right, the red tape argument.
Exactly. Second, it mobilizes a multi-agency effort involving commerce, defense, transportation, NASA, to expedite spaceport infrastructure development. This includes aligning reviews, eliminating duplication, and fast-tracking approvals for new spaceport projects.
Uh-huh.
And critically, this part even scrutinizes whether states are hindering development through their implementation of the Coastal Zone Management Act, the CZMA.
Ooh, that sounds like stepping on some state toes.
Potentially, yes. Beyond these, it also streamlines authorizations for cutting-edge activities like in-space manufacturing and includes a significant bureaucratic reorganization to centralize deregulation efforts. It fundamentally reorients the FAA and Commerce Department's approach to space.
The reactions were pretty enthusiastic from within the government and the industry itself, weren't they?
Oh, definitely. Acting NASA Administrator Sean Duffy and FAA Administrator Brian Bedford both enthusiastically praised the order. They talked about slashing red tape and positioning U.S. companies to dominate commercial space activities.
Right.
Industry analysts call it a major win for companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, ULA, Rocket Lab. They expect faster licensing and development timelines. It's clear the industry was ready for these changes and views them as a significant boost.
But as with most significant policy shifts, there's always another side. Environmental organizations, for one, were not so thrilled, I imagine.
That's putting it mildly. Groups like the Center for Biological Diversity called it reckless.
Reckless, wow.
Yes, warning that it puts people and wildlife at risk by allowing federal agencies to ignore bedrock environmental laws. They pointed to past launch damage as evidence that robust oversight is needed, not weakened regulations. So this highlights a really clear tension between accelerating economic activity and protecting the environment.
And this next point really highlights that tension, especially for anyone listening who lives in a coastal state like Florida or Texas or California. This could have direct impacts on local land use and environmental policy. What makes this particular detail so critical?
Well, what's truly insightful here is that the implications extend beyond just the environment. The decision to make the head of the FAA's Commercial Space Office a political appointee is a significant politicization of what has traditionally been a very technical, safety-focused regulatory role.
How so?
Well, career staff typically apply regulations based on technical and safety merits, right? That's their job. A political appointee, however, serves at the pleasure of the president and is specifically tasked with implementing the administration's agenda, which in this case is explicitly stated as increasing launch cadence.
Ah, so politics over technical details, potentially.
That's the risk. It subordinates technical decision-making to political goals, introducing a substantial risk that expediency could be prioritized over technical due diligence or safety protocols.
That's a crucial point. And the federal-state conflict you mentioned with the Coastal Zone Management Act, that could get pretty messy down the line, couldn't it?
Absolutely. The directive for federal agencies to scrutinize state compliance with CZMA and report any state or local limitations on spaceport development to the Department of Justice, that's a very clear assertion of federal primacy.
It sounds like the Fed's saying, get out of the way.
Essentially, yes. It tasks federal agencies with acting as watchdogs, identifying state and local regulations as impediments to a national priority. Given that major launch facilities are in coastal states, often with strong environmental laws, this really sets the stage for future legal battles.
Okay.
It's not just about streamlining federal rules. It's about leveraging federal power to potentially override state and local opposition to industrial development, particularly in environmentally sensitive zones.
Beyond the high-profile executive orders, the administration also made more subtle, targeted regulatory rollbacks. The USPTO case study on August 14th really highlights this adaptability in their approach. What happened there?
Right. So on August 14th, a final rule from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the USPTO, became effective, and it formally eliminated the dedicated program for expedited examination of design applications. Now, this might sound like a small technical change, but its significance lies in the underlying strategy it reveals.
Okay, what was the USPTO's rationale for this? Why get rid of an expedited program?
Well, the USPTO's stated rationale was all about administrative efficiency and anti-fraud enforcement. They reported a staggering 560% surge in expedited requests in recent years.
Wow, 560%.
Yeah, huge jump. And they attributed it largely to fraudulent applications and an increase in erroneous microentity certifications. They argued this deluge was creating backlogs and negatively impacting processing times for all legitimate applications.
Okay, so a system overload argument.
Exactly. So they presented it as a procedural fix to combat abuse and protect the system's integrity. And while this specific expedited pathway was removed, it's worth noting applicants can still use the more general accelerated examination program or petition for special examination based on age or health.
So what does this all mean for you? Maybe if you're an entrepreneur, an inventor, or just someone observing how government works, what's the takeaway?
I think this is a classic case study in using a good governance rationale for what is essentially a deregulatory outcome. It's framed as technical and non-ideological, right? Just cleaning up the system, which makes it far less susceptible to the kind of political criticism we saw with the broader executive orders. It is. The practical effect is the removal of a specific regulatory option that had been available. It's a subtle but highly effective way to simplify the regulatory code under a rationale that's hard to oppose. It really demonstrates the administration's adaptability in its deregulatory playbook, showing a willingness to use different justifications to achieve similar outcomes across various sectors.
Moving from the economy, let's pivot now to how the administration is asserting national interests on the global stage. The last 48 hours showed a very assertive, often unilateral approach to foreign and national security policy.
Yeah, the striking thing here is the consistent preference for the direct application of American economic and military leverage. It's quite pronounced. We see a highly coordinated pressure campaign against Mexican drug cartels, very targeted use of things like visa sanctions alongside, you know, high-stakes diplomacy with major powers. It's a multifaceted approach clearly tailored to the specific target and the perceived leverage the U.S. has.
And the first, most striking example of this seems to be that coordinated offensive against transnational criminal organizations on August 13th. This wasn't just one agency acting alone, was it?
No, not at all. It was a true whole-of-government approach, explicitly framing Mexican drug cartels as a premier national security threat. The Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, kicked things off by sanctioning three high-ranking members and one associate of the Cartel del Noreste, or CDN, they used to be Los Zetas.
Right, OFAC sanctions. That freezes assets.
Exactly. These individuals, Abdon Federico Rodriguez Garcia, Francisco Daniel Esqueda Nieto, Antonio Romero Sanchez, and even a narco rapper named Ricardo Hernandez Medrano, were targeted under both counter-narcotics and counter-terrorism authorities. This freezes any U.S. assets they might have and, crucially, prohibits U.S. persons and entities from having any dealings with them. It effectively cuts off their access to the U.S. financial system.
And the Department of Justice and the DEA weren't far behind, were they? They had their own major announcement.
Not at all. Almost in lockstep, DEA Administrator Cole announced that 26 fugitives had been transferred from Mexico into U.S. custody. And these weren't low-level operatives. They were facing serious charges: drug trafficking, kidnapping, murder.
Significant players.
Very significant. The list included key figures like Abigail Elquini, Gonzalez Valencia. He's a leader of the Las Cuinas organization, which is basically the financial arm of the CJNG cartel, a major cocaine trafficker. Others included Kevin Gil Acosta and Martin Zazueta Perez, both described as security leaders for the Sinaloa cartel involved with fentanyl labs, and even Roberto Salazar, who was wanted for the 2008 murder of a Los Angeles County sheriff's deputy.
Wow, so a major blow to cartel leadership.
It was intended as such, a significant and impactful haul aimed at dismantling cartel leadership structures.
This sounds like it's part of a much larger ongoing strategy to confront these cartels, not just a one-off operation.
Oh, definitely. These actions are part of a broader strategic shift that includes formally designating some cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, or FTOs.
FTO designation. That has significant implications, right?
Huge implications. The FTO designation provides the legal architecture for much harsher penalties, expanded U.S. jurisdiction, and potentially even the use of military force down the line. It also criminalizes material support for these groups. And this follows earlier aggressive financial actions, like the June 2025 sanctions against Mexican financial institutions accused of laundering money for cartels. It's a pattern.
The synchronized timing of the Treasury sanctions, the financial pressure, and the Justice Department extraditions physically removing people really stands out as particularly effective.
Absolutely. Stepping back, that synchronized timing,
yeah.
The financial strangulation through OFAC sanctions combined with the physical removal of key personnel through extraditions, it shows a highly sophisticated weaponization of financial and legal power. It's designed to be far more disruptive than either action alone would be. And then you layer on the FTO designation, which adds this credible threat of military force and enhanced penalties. It applies pressure across the entire cartel ecosystem, affecting everyone involved, whether willingly or under duress.
This approach, while aggressive, really highlights a critical dependence on the Mexican government's cooperation, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The DEA specifically thanked Mexico's national security team for their collaboration.
That's a key point.
What are the deeper implications of this reliance?
Well, this reliance undeniably gives Mexico significant leverage. It's a two-way street. Should political friction arise over other contentious issues, thinking that, like, trade immigration, Mexico could potentially slow or even halt this cooperation.
And that would cripple the U.S. strategy.
It would severely cripple the U.S. anti-cartel strategy. So this assertive posture, while seemingly unilateral from the U.S. side, is paradoxically quite dependent on a cooperative relationship with its southern neighbor. It raises an important question for you to think about. How sustainable is such an aggressive strategy if it relies so heavily on a cooperative foreign partner? And what happens when that cooperation is inevitably tested by other bilateral tensions?
Moving on, the administration's approach to foreign security assistance was also clearly illustrated by a major proposed arms sale to Nigeria on August 13th. What were the details of this deal?
Right. The State Department approved a potential foreign military sale, or FMS, to the government of Nigeria. The estimated value is around $306 million. The Defense Security Cooperation Agency, DSCA, formally notified Congress of this potential sale.
And what's in the package? What kind of capabilities are we talking about?
It's substantial and heavily focused on air-to-ground strike capabilities. The package includes over 1,000 MK-82 500-pound general-purpose bombs, plus over 1,500 guidance kits, things called airfoil groups and computer control groups that convert these dumb bombs into precision-guided Paveway 2 smart bombs, the GBU-12s and GBU-58s.
So precision strike capability.
Exactly. And it also includes 5,000 Advanced Precision Kill Weapon System, or APKWS, kits. These turn standard helicopter rockets into laser-guided precision munitions, plus programmable fuses, support equipment, training, the whole package. It significantly boosts their ability to conduct targeted operations from the air.
What was the stated rationale for such a significant arms sale? Why Nigeria? Why now?
The official rationale given was to support the foreign policy goals and national security objectives of the United States by improving the security of a strategic partner in sub-Saharan Africa. More specifically, the explicit purpose is to enhance the Nigerian military's capability to conduct operations against entrenched terrorist organizations like Boko Haram and ISWAP.
Right. Ongoing threats.
Major ongoing threats. And also to counter illicit trafficking in the Gulf of Guinea. The DSCA assessment included in the notification stated that Nigeria could absorb these munitions and that the sale wouldn't fundamentally alter the regional military balance.
This really exemplifies a transactional approach to counterterrorism, doesn't it? Prioritizing military hardware as the primary instrument. The U.S. identifies a problem, provides tools, it limits direct U.S. entanglement, but it also carries inherent risks.
It does. Providing advanced weaponry without concurrently addressing the root causes of conflict, things like poverty, endemic corruption, poor governance may only treat the symptoms.
And the weapons could end up in the wrong hands.
That's the fear. Worse, these weapons could potentially be misused by security forces, leading to human rights abuses. That was a past concern that actually delayed earlier sales to Nigeria.
All right, I remember that.
Or they could even be diverted or captured by the very groups they're meant to fight. It happens. So it's a calculated bet on military capacity being the most effective solution, but it's a bet with clear and well-documented risks. And it again raises a question for you. What's the long-term impact on regional stability if those underlying issues are left unaddressed and the focus remains solely on military solutions?
Finally, on the diplomatic front, the administration showcased a very distinct sort of two-track approach over these couple of days.
Yeah, the striking thing here is the stark contrast in methods, depending on who they're dealing with. On one hand, you have unilateral coercive measures, and on the other, high-level personal diplomacy. For the coercive track, on August 13th, Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced visa restrictions and revocations for foreign officials. This targeted officials from Brazil, Cuba, Grenada, some unnamed African nations, and even former officials from the Pan American Health Organization, PAHO.
Okay, visa restrictions. And the reason for this action? Why target these specific officials?
The stated reason was their alleged complicity in facilitating Cuba's overseas medical mission program. The U.S. characterizes this program as a coercive labor export scheme that exploits Cuban medical professionals. So this is a direct punitive measure designed to pressure other countries to align with U.S.-Cuba policy.
Right.
It's a clear exercise of raw U.S. power intended to compel a change in behavior through sanctions, using access to the U.S. as leverage.
And then on the other track, we saw high-level personal diplomacy regarding the Ukraine war. Very different approach.
Completely different, yes. Also on August 13th, the president held discussions with key European leaders regarding the ongoing war in Ukraine. He reportedly told his counterparts that Russian President Vladimir Putin must agree to a ceasefire at an upcoming summit or face, quote, very severe consequences.
Okay, so still a hard line, but through negotiation.
Exactly. While taking a hard line, the engagement was fundamentally one of negotiation, not unilateral imposition. The leaders apparently agreed on a common strategy for the summit. And the president indicated that a follow-up trilateral summit involving Russia and Ukraine could happen almost immediately if the initial summit was successful. This is negotiation, recognizing that coercive tools are simply insufficient with major geopolitical competitors.
What makes this so critical, I think, is that stark contrast. On one hand, you have unilateral sanctions against smaller nations or for specific policy enforcement. On the other, high-stakes negotiations with peer competitors.
It reveals a very bifurcated, maybe pragmatic strategy. For smaller nations or specific policy enforcement where the U.S. feels it has the upper hand, they readily employ unilateral and coercive tools to achieve policy alignment.
Makes sense.
But for major geopolitical issues involving peer competitors, where those tools are insufficient or potentially counterproductive, they pivot to direct, high-stakes, often personalized negotiations. It's a tiered approach, adapting methods based on international power dynamics and the perceived leverage the U.S. holds in each specific scenario.
Okay, now let's move into what seems to be one of the most contentious areas of this 48-hour period. The profound and, frankly, controversial actions within the Department of Health and Human Services. These aren't just administrative tweaks, are they? They seem to be aiming for a fundamental reorientation of public health itself.
Yeah, the striking thing here is the clear ideological agenda. It seems aimed at centralizing political control over the health bureaucracy, directly challenging established scientific consensus, and fundamentally reorienting public health priorities. This aggressive transformation campaign has already sparked significant legal and institutional backlash, positioning HHS as a central battleground in the administration's broader effort to remake the federal government.
Starting with health security, on August 13th, the president signed an executive order titled Ensuring American Pharmaceutical Supply Chain Resilience by Filling the Strategic Active Pharmaceutical Ingredients Reserve.
Bit of a mouthful.
It is. What are the key directives within this order? What's it actually telling HHS to do?
Okay. The order tasks the HHS Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, that's ASPR, with several urgent actions. First, within just 30 days, ASPR must identify a list of approximately 26 drugs deemed especially critical to national health and security.
30 days, that's fast.
Very fast. Second, subject to funding, ASPR is charged with obtaining a 6-month supply of the active pharmaceutical ingredients, or APIs. Those are the core chemical components of drugs needed to manufacture these critical medicines. And there is an explicit preference for domestically manufactured APIs. These are to be stored in the Strategic Active Pharmaceutical Ingredients Reserve, AAPR.
Okay, so stockpiling domestic ingredients.
Right. And third, the order instructs ASPR to update a larger 2022 list of 86 essential medicines, plan to procure a 6-month API supply for those as well, and propose a second SEPARA repository within 1 year. It's a big buildup.
And the administration's rationale for this? Why the big push for domestic APIs?
It's deeply rooted in national security concerns. The White House highlighted that only about 10% of APIs for U.S. prescription drugs are manufactured domestically.
Only 10%? That seems low.
It is quite low, and it leaves the nation vulnerable, they argue, to supply chain disruptions from foreign, sometimes adversarial nations.
Right.
They criticized the previous administration for failing to advance domestic sources and for leaving this APIR nearly empty. Stockpiling APIs, which are generally cheaper and have longer shelf lives than finished drugs, is presented as a cost-effective way to ensure resilience during emergencies and reduce that foreign dependency.
But this will almost certainly increase costs, won't it?
Yeah.
Foreign APIs are generally cheaper for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
So the American taxpayer will bear this security premium.
Mm-hmm.
How might this strategy play out in the long term for the pharmaceutical industry and, you know, for you as a consumer?
That's the key question. In the broader context, this effectively operationalizes economic nationalism within public health. The policy's ultimate success really hinges on whether onshoring API production is both feasible and economically viable long term. Can it actually work?
Right.
The preference for domestic APIs is a clear government intervention designed to stimulate a domestic manufacturing industry by creating a guaranteed federal customer. The crucial long-term question is whether this domestic API industry, kind of kick-started by government purchasing, can eventually become self-sustaining and globally competitive, or if it will require a permanent state of government subsidy just to survive.
A big bet.
It's a major strategic bet on industrial policy in a really critical sector.
Perhaps the most contentious development in this sector, though, centers on the politicization of public health science, specifically regarding the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP. This crisis has been building since June 2025, right? It didn't just happen now.
That's correct. The crisis really ignited back in June when HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. took the unprecedented step of dismissing the entire 17-member panel of the ACIP.
The whole committee? Wow.
Whole committee. And ACIP isn't just some minor group. It's a congressionally mandated body of independent experts. Their recommendations form the legal and scientific basis for vaccine coverage and schedules across the entire United States. Very important.
So who replaced them?
The 17 fired experts were replaced with a much smaller group of just 8 individuals, and several of these new members are well known for their public criticism of vaccines and established public health policies. Mm. People like Dr. Robert Malone and Martin Kulldorff.
Okay, so replacing experts with known critics, that's bound to cause friction.
Massive friction, and the controversy really intensified on August 13th, drawing in sharp congressional criticism.
What happened then?
Senator Richard Blumenthal sent a scathing letter to Secretary Kennedy demanding Dr. Malone's immediate removal from the committee. The letter drew a direct line between what it characterized as Dr. Malone's recent online posts containing violent and threatening images and a deadly shooting that had occurred just days earlier at the CDC headquarters. The gunman was reportedly motivated by misinformation about COVID-19 vaccines.
Oh, wow. Linking online rhetoric to real-world violence.
Exactly. Senator Blumenthal argued that Dr. Malone's rhetoric was dangerous and that his presence on a federal advisory panel was an unfathomable failure of judgment. Strong words.
And it wasn't just Senator Blumenthal raising alarms, was it? This sparked widespread condemnation from the medical community.
No, the condemnation was immediate and widespread. A huge coalition of the nation's most prominent medical and public health organizations, we're talking the American Academy of Pediatrics, AAP, the American Medical Association, AMA, the Infectious Diseases Society of America, IDSA, dozens of others issued strong statements decrying the mass firing of the ACIP members.
What were their main concerns?
They warned that the move would severely erode public trust, silence independent scientific expertise, and pose a direct threat to the health of the nation. The AAP even took the extraordinary step of boycotting the new ACIP's first meeting, stating that the process was no longer credible.
Boycotting the meeting. That's a huge statement.
It is, and the meeting itself was widely described as being in crisis. Reports said it abandoned its prior scientific agenda to focus instead on politically charged and, frankly, long-debunked topics like the presence of thimerosal in vaccines.
It makes you wonder, if you were a career scientist at the CDC right now, what's running through your mind? How do you balance scientific integrity with career survival in that kind of environment? This situation must have a chilling effect on federal scientists. The dismissal of the entire ACIP panel, plus that public resignation of a senior CDC scientist who feared a lot of Americans are going to die, it sends a pretty clear message. Dissent could be career ending.
Absolutely. This is more than just placing political allies onto a committee. It feels like a fundamental assault on the process and legitimacy of institutional science itself. ACIP's authority, historically, derived from its perceived objectivity, its scientific rigor, its transparent, evidence-based process.
Right.
By replacing credentialed experts with vocal critics and shifting the committee's focus away from evidence, the administration seems to be actively working to invalidate the very concept of a trusted, independent scientific advisory body. The goal appears to be replacing evidence-based medicine with the administration's own ideological preferences.
And the long-term impact.
Well, this will likely cause a brain drain of top scientific talent from federal service. People will leave, and it will foster a culture of self-censorship among those who remain. Scientists may become hesitant to present data or conclusions that contradict the administration's narrative simply for fear of retribution.
Mm-hmm.
This internal suppression poses a grave long-term threat to the quality and integrity of government decision-making across all critical issues, not just vaccines.
As if that wasn't enough disruption, on August 14th, HHS announced a massive departmental restructuring plan. This sounds like an effort to solidify these ideological shifts through bureaucratic means, maybe?
It certainly looks that way. The plan's stated goals are, you know, the usual: streamline operations and save money, an estimated $1.8 billion annually. Primarily, the saving comes through a reduction of approximately 10,000 full-time employees, which is part of a larger planned downsizing of 20,000 across HHS.
10,000 jobs. Mm. That's significant.
It's huge. The plan proposes consolidating 28 existing divisions into just 15 new ones and centralizing core administrative functions like HR, IT, and procurement. Key structural changes include creating a new Administration for a Healthy America, or AHA. This AHA would combine multiple existing agencies like the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, and the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA.
Yeah.
The plan also transfers the Administration for Strategic Preparedness and Response, ASPR, over to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. And it establishes a new Assistant Secretary for Enforcement to combat waste, fraud, and abuse.
The administration's rationale goes beyond just efficiency, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The press release language hinted at something more ideological.
Absolutely. The press release explicitly links the overhaul to a new priority of ending America's epidemic of chronic illness by focusing on safe, wholesome food, clean water, and the elimination of environmental toxins.
Okay. That sounds like the secretary's personal focus.
It very much does. This framing reveals that the restructuring is not merely an administrative exercise. It appears to be a vehicle for embedding a specific and controversial ideological mission Secretary Kennedy's personal advocacy on environmental toxins into the very structure of HHS, particularly through the creation of this new AHA.
So for you, the citizen who relies on public health services, what are the inevitable shifts that could occur due to this massive restructuring? What does it mean on the ground?
Well, it will inevitably shift departmental resources, funding, and personnel towards this new mission focused on environmental toxins and chronic illness. That could potentially come at the expense of other more traditional public health functions, things like infectious disease surveillance, maybe, or other existing programs.
Right. Resources aren't infinite.
Exactly. It represents a top-down effort to remake the department's scientific and policy priorities in the image of its political leadership, using the powerful tool of bureaucratic reorganization to achieve ideological goals. It's a fundamental reorientation of what HHS prioritizes and how it operates, and that has real-world consequences for the public health services you might rely on.
Amidst this aggressive push to reshape health policy, the judicial branch emerged as a significant check on executive power. Tell us about that. On August 12th, a U.S. district court granted a preliminary injunction.
Yes, blocking HHS from implementing a new policy. This policy would have allowed them to share personal health care data of Medicaid beneficiaries with the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, specifically for immigration enforcement purposes.
Sharing Medicaid data for immigration enforcement, that sounds controversial.
Highly controversial. The core takeaway here is the basis of the ruling. The lawsuit was brought by a multi-state coalition of attorneys general led by California, including states like Michigan and Minnesota. They argued that this abrupt reversal of a long-standing policy protecting data confidentiality was illegal. And crucially, they argued it was creating a climate of fear, causing eligible immigrants to avoid seeking necessary medical care, which harms public health overall.
Okay, and the court agreed.
The court agreed, at least for now, with the preliminary injunction. The ruling was grounded in the Administrative Procedure Act, the APA. The judge found that the plaintiff states were likely to succeed on their claim that the policy change was arbitrary and capricious in violation of the APA.
Arbitrary and capricious, that's key APA language.
It is. The court specifically noted that HHS and DHS had failed to engage in reasoned decision-making before changing the policy. And importantly, they failed to consider the significant reliance that states, providers, and patients had placed on the previous confidentiality protections. They didn't do their homework, essentially.
This is highly significant, isn't it? It demonstrates the APA as a key line of defense against rapid executive action. The court focused on the process of the policy change, not necessarily the policy itself.
Exactly. The court found HHS failed this fundamental process test.
So for you, whether you're in government, a nonprofit, or just observing, this provides a clear roadmap, right? It shows how future legal challenges to rapid, ideologically driven policy changes might succeed if they're made without a thorough, documented, and reasoned administrative process.
Absolutely. This forces the administration into a choice. Either slow its pace to build a proper, legally defensible administrative record for its actions, or risk repeated and potentially successful defeats in federal court. It sends a clear message that procedural due diligence isn't optional, even when you're pursuing an ambitious policy agenda.
Right.
And it raises another important question for you to ponder. Will the administration prioritize speed, or will it prioritize administrative due diligence moving forward? And how will that tension play out in future policy implementation across the board?
Finally, let's look at how the administration is approaching domestic governance, specifically a really significant federal intervention in the District of Columbia.
Yeah, what truly stands out here is how this action, and maybe even more so the rhetoric surrounding it, raises fundamental questions about DC home rule, the separation of powers, and the constitutional limits of presidential authority in an emergency. It's a bold assertion of executive power right in the heart of the nation's capital.
So on August 11th, the president signed Executive Order 14333 titled Declaring a Crime Emergency in the District of Columbia. What did this order actually do?
Okay, this order invoked a specific provision of the DC Home Rule Act. That's the federal law governing DC. This provision grants the president the authority to assume control of the city's Metropolitan Police Department, MPD, for a period of up to 30 days in what's deemed an emergency.
So the president takes over the local police.
Essentially, yes, for that limited period. The action was immediately accompanied by a visible deployment of federal law enforcement agents and National Guard troops in parts of the city. It represented a significant federal override of the authority of the district's elected government, which usually maintains control over its own police force. A big step.
But the most significant development wasn't just the order itself, but the president's public comments on August 13th regarding extensions beyond that initial 30 days. This feels like maybe a political trial balloon being floated.
That's precisely where it got really fascinating and potentially concerning for separation of powers.
Ah.
The Home Rule Act is explicit. Any extension of federal control over the MPD beyond 30 days requires an act of Congress. Congress has to approve it.
Okay, clear requirement.
Very clear. However, during a public event, the president hinted he might not consider congressional approval necessary. He stated, and I'm quoting here, "If it's a national emergency, we can do it without Congress, but we expect to be before Congress very quickly. I don't want to call a national emergency, but if I have to, I will."
Hmm. Suggesting a national emergency declaration could override the Home Rule Act.
That's the implication. This executive order was then published in the Federal Register on August 14th, making it official policy, while those comments simultaneously opened up this new avenue of potential constitutional confrontation.
This statement really represents a clear and deliberate test of legal and constitutional boundaries, doesn't it? By floating the idea of using a general national emergency power to circumvent the Home Rule Act's explicit congressional approval requirement, the president is signaling a willingness to pit one potential source of authority against the clear limitations set by another specific statute.
Yes.
This decision has profound implications for you if you're observing the balance of power in U.S. government.
Exactly. And the implications are profound, extending far beyond just D.C. home rule. It suggests a potential constitutional confrontation with Congress over the separation of powers and the legislative branch's fundamental powers of oversight and, you know, holding the purse strings.
Right.
It reflects a view of the presidency where emergency declarations can serve as a potent tool to bypass statutory limits and unilaterally expand executive authority. That has far-reaching consequences for the balance of power at the very heart of the U.S. government. It's a clear signal of an expansive view of presidential power, particularly in a declared emergency.
And while those are the big headline-grabbing moves, we also saw the continued everyday regulatory work of the federal government chugging along on August 14th, even amidst these larger, more controversial policy shifts.
Yeah, that's right. For instance, the Federal Register also published an executive order on China tariffs on the 14th. That shows that major economic policy tools are still being deployed on a daily basis, even if they don't make the top headlines that day.
Still part of the ongoing machinery.
Absolutely. And then at the other end of the spectrum, the FDA published a minor correction to a proposed rule on the standard of identity for pasteurized orange juice.
Okay, not quite as dramatic.
Not quite. But while less dramatic, these actions demonstrate that the vast, complex machinery of the federal government continues its routine operations and minor adjustments. That constant hum of activity underpins everything else, even as major ideological transformations are underway at the higher levels.
Okay, let's try to bring all of this together now.
Yeah.
This wasn't just a random collection of actions over 48 hours. It really feels like a very clear demonstration of a distinct, overarching governing philosophy in action.
I agree. In the broader context, these events reveal an administration deeply committed to rapid executive-led transformation across multiple policy domains. They showcase a very deliberate and consistent strategic approach to reshaping the American landscape, both domestically and internationally. It really is like watching a strategic playbook being executed in real time.
Can you maybe summarize those overarching themes of governance that connect everything we've discussed? What are the key threads you see?
Certainly. I think a few major themes emerge quite clearly. First, there's a strong theme of executive-led transformation. We see a consistent preference for using the speed and power of executive orders and other unilateral administrative actions to enact rapid and far-reaching policy changes.
Bypassing Congress.
Often seeking to bypass or directly challenge the slower, more deliberative processes of the legislative branch. And as we saw with the Medicaid data lawsuit, it's frequently met with judicial resistance based on process.
Okay, theme one.
Second, deregulation as targeted industrial policy is clearly evident. The administration is redefining competition away from traditional antitrust enforcement, which polices market concentration. Instead, it's adopting a model of targeted deregulation for nationally significant industries like commercial space, like domestic pharmaceuticals. This constitutes a form of industrial policy where the government actively picks and promotes sectors it deems critical, removing regulatory burdens to foster their growth and global dominance.
Choosing winners, essentially.
That's one way to put it. Third, we see assertive economic and security nationalism. An America First posture underpins both foreign and security policy. This is demonstrated through a combination of coercive tools, sanctions, tariffs, visa restrictions, and that high-level personal diplomacy we talked about. Partnerships are often viewed through a transactional lens, and the administration has shown a willingness to use a whole-of-government approach, weaponizing financial and legal tools in tandem to pursue national security objectives, like we saw with the aggressive campaign against drug cartels.
Right.
Fourth, there's a significant politicization of science and bureaucracy. There's a clear willingness to challenge and even dismantle established norms of scientific independence and bureaucratic procedure in order to align federal agencies with a specific political and ideological agenda. The mass replacement of the expert ACIP panel and the top-down restructuring of HHS to reflect the political priorities of its leadership are stark illustrations of this.
Treating experts as political tools.
That's the concern. This approach treats the civil service and scientific advisory bodies not as independent sources of expertise, but as instruments for implementing a specific political program. And finally, a recurring theme is probing the limits of power. The administration has demonstrated a consistent pattern of testing the legal and constitutional boundaries of executive authority. This is evident in its challenge to state-level environmental regulations, its use of the Administrative Procedure Act in ways that invite judicial rebuke, and most pointedly, in its rhetoric surrounding the potential use of national emergency powers to circumvent explicit statutory limitations imposed by Congress. It's a continuous exploration of just how far executive power can be stretched.
This paints a picture of a very active, very strategic, and sometimes very disruptive federal government, rapidly trying to reshape policy and power dynamics. Given this dynamic and often disruptive environment, there are some nonpartisan recommendations or takeaways for key stakeholders, aren't there? What should state and local governments be thinking about, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. For state and local governments, I think the first thing is prepare for preemption conflicts. Mm-hmm. Expect continued federal efforts to override state and local regulations, particularly in areas like environmental protection, land use, and public health, especially when they clash with stated federal priorities.
So get ready for fights.
Basically. Second, strengthen administrative law expertise. The APA has proven to be a critical tool for challenging federal actions. State attorneys general should ensure their legal teams have deep expertise in APA litigation, focusing on procedural deficiencies and that arbitrary and capricious standard. Know the rulebook.
Okay.
And finally, build and maintain multi-state coalitions. The success of the lawsuit blocking the HHS-DHS data sharing agreement demonstrates the power of collective action. Proactively building these coalitions to pool legal resources and present a united front is essential for effective resistance or negotiation. There's strength in numbers.
And what about for the private sector? What should businesses be watching?
For regulated industries, business strategies really must be reevaluated in light of the administration's clear preference for deregulation in specific sectors.
Right.
Companies in favored industries, commercial space, domestic manufacturing, defense, can probably anticipate a more permissive regulatory environment and maybe even potential government support.
Yeah.
Opportunity there.
But risks too.
Definitely. Conversely, all companies must prepare for a less predictable and potentially more politicized antitrust enforcement landscape, where the rules of the game might shift unexpectedly. And specifically for financial institutions, those aggressive sanctions against Mexican financial institutions serve as a critical warning. Compliance departments must urgently enhance their anti-money laundering, AML, and know your customer KYC protocols, particularly for any transactions with a nexus to regions targeted by U.S. counter-narcotics and counter-terrorism efforts. The evidence shows that institutional reputation is not a shield against sanctions, and the threshold for action is reasonable belief, not necessarily a criminal conviction. So diligence is key.
Okay. What about non-governmental organizations and civil society groups? What's the advice for them?
For NGOs and civil society, advocacy and monitoring efforts should be intensely focused on the administrative process itself. Documenting procedural failures, the lack of a reasoned decision-making process, the absence of an evidence-based record, this can provide the crucial foundation for effective legal and political challenges down the road. Follow the paper trail.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, amplify coalitional voices. The broad coalition of medical organizations opposing the ACIP changes demonstrates the power of a unified expert voice. NGOs should work to build such coalitions to amplify public awareness and political pressure on the administration and Congress, leveraging collective expertise for greater impact. Unite and speak out.
And finally, for our international partners, what should other countries take away from this?
Foreign governments really need to adapt to that two-track U.S. diplomatic strategy we discussed. Expect transactional and at times coercive engagement on issues where the U.S. perceives it has a significant power advantage. But on major geopolitical challenges, be prepared for direct high-stakes negotiations that may be driven more by personalized leadership dynamics rather than traditional diplomatic channels. It depends on the issue and the counterpart. And importantly, recognize the interconnectivity of issues. Understand that cooperation on one front, like law enforcement against cartels, may be viewed by the U.S. as leverage to be used in other policy areas, like trade or immigration. Everything can be linked. A holistic and strategic approach to bilateral relations is essential, recognizing these broader potential implications. And this really raises a final important question for you, the listener, to consider. How will these rapid executive-led transformations reshape the very fabric of American governance and its relationship with the world in the long term? What checks and balances will prove most effective in this new landscape, and what will be the lasting legacy of such concentrated executive action?
And that brings us to the end of our deep dive into the federal news update for Thursday, August 14th, 2025. We've covered, well, a huge amount, everything from competition policy in space to national security operations and the profound reshaping of health bureaucracy.
It's a fascinating, if sometimes maybe disquieting, look at the mechanisms of power and policy in action. A truly busy 48 hours we unpacked there.
We certainly hope this exhaustive look has provided you with a deeper understanding of this pivotal 48-hour period in U.S. federal policy. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. And remember, the more you know, the more interesting the world becomes. We'll be back soon with another deep dive tailored just for you.